All right. Yeah, there you go.
Okay, there we go. One of the things that intrigued me in the course of listening to this was I imagined the alternative editing jobs that I could have done on that. One of them, I could have produced an interview of some length in which you reinforced every basic principle of KPFA at its founding and sounded like one of the original founders supporting precisely the principles that were put forward at the beginning of the station.
You know, I was struck by that myself because when I did this interview in April of 1993, I obviously hadn't read your monograph, but I read it last night. And as I saw myself speaking here, I got a chill in my spine saying, you know, I'm one of them and I never knew it.
Yeah, well, it's history,
I mean, I suspected it. Yeah. I mm-hmm. obviously have been aware of these
but
things.
But you are a historian, among other things, a contemporary historian. And you probably had not read as deeply into the early history of KPFA as some of this goes. And there is to me a line of continuity and diversity in the station which has stayed up to the present. I think my opinion is that from what I've observed that you probably, if one had to pick an individual, that you would represent the broadest spectrum of opinion, of cultural diversity, of openness, of about anybody who is still around the station, on the premises, operating.
Well, it was interesting to me because last year they were selecting a new station manager, and I don't work there very often anymore. As I say, I work on national affairs. I know I can walk in the building now and not recognize fully half the people I run into or even more. I don't know who they are. Most of them know who I am, but I don't know who they are. And last year, because of the way the station manager was going to be selected, I felt I should get involved again. And the executive director, outgoing executive director, with whom I've had a lot of conflicts, David Solniker, did not want to appoint me to the committee that was going to select the new manager. So I decided I would run for one of these slots allocated to unpaid programmers, to volunteers. I would put my name in and get voted on by the unpaid staff. And it turned out I not only won that election, but I got twice as many votes as anybody else, many of whom must have come from people that I don't even know. So I think you may be right that there is, on that level, you know, if we can think of elections as reflecting anything, mm-hmm. I think there's maybe still a broad recognition that I do make contact with various segments of the of the existing institution.
But I think that you embody one of the conflicts within Pacifica over the years, going back a long way.
Just
ways.
One? Probably a lot of them.
one in particular that I think is central, and that is the conflict between the desire, the need, the demand for intellectual excellence, for lack of a better word, integrity, for at the baldest level, simplest level, going on the air and saying things that are worth listening to, that the largest number of people want to listen to, including members of divergent minority groups. And on the other hand, the feeling which you express so well, the conviction that you express so well, that the station must be opened up to those who do not have a platform elsewhere. But having done that, and they stream in off the streets, who makes that necessary decision as to who actually is going to be allowed to go on the air and talk? At the baldest level, idiots are deserving people. I mean, they have rights, like everyone
and
else.
And some of the idiots are listeners.
Yeah.
And some listeners are idiots. But not all. Not even the majority.
But at some point along a spectrum, one says, this person is not verbal enough. This person is not sufficiently coherent. We can't put him or her on the air.
Well, there are problems involved in that area, and there always will be. I mean, the two central, what I teach my students when I teach political science and mass media classes is that one of the key questions you have to ask about any human structure that's been invented, any entity, any organization, is number one, who decides? And number two, who decides who decides? And these are important questions. And you're absolutely right. Ever since the founding of Pacifica, as I read in your monograph and heard from older people who've been around, these have always been critical questions involved. As a journalist, as a broadcast journalist, when I teach interviewing techniques, I try to teach people, how do you get the essence of what a person is about when they're perhaps not articulate, when they're perhaps shy, when they're perhaps scared, when they're perhaps trying to hide something, when they perhaps don't speak your language, when they perhaps don't trust you? How do you manage to make that bridge? This is an important art, really, of radio broadcasting. Great interviewers, like Elsa Knight Thompson, for example, knew how to do this. We have great interviewers who actually function in broadcasting today, people like Terry Gross on Fresh Air or Bryant Gumbel on NBC. I mean, there's lots of people that I respect who know how to do interviewing techniques. And these can be taught, but like anything else, some people learn them well and some people don't learn them well. And because KPFA and Pacifica are community radio stations, a lot of times the people who go on the air are not good interviewers. They're not skilled at what they do. They don't put their subjects at ease. They don't get to the essence of the subject. They do push their own agendas. They do put their emotional content and their own particular menu out front to the detriment of the person they're supposed to be speaking to. You're right. These are continuing problems. When, you know... Who was it? Goering said, when I hear the word culture, I reach for my gun.
Yeah.
When I hear the word intellectual...
For my Luger, he says.
By Luger? Yeah. Then Goffish,
no, by God, it was Browning. It was Browning, yeah.
Somebody said.
Anyway, yeah. Got to be accurate about
Goering.
These things.
when I hear the word intellectual content, it gets my hackles up, because often in my life, I speak to people in this country and abroad who are not educated in the sense that we know education to be, who do not have advanced degrees, who perhaps are even illiterate in some cases, who are extremely intelligent and perceptive and knowledgeable about human nature, life, politics, whatever it is. And it doesn't have to do with their intellectual content or how many great authors of whatever stripe they've assimilated, but how they've been miraculously somehow able to use their minds. Mm-hmm. And we may not have any longer, we certainly don't have any longer, as I read, you know, the old program guides that you reproduce in your monograph, we don't have a lot of those kind of programs on the air any longer, nor do we have the type of people who could even produce those kind of programs. And I'm not sure those kind of people even exist anymore, except among the surviving elders of the tribe who still are on the planet. But there are other ways of one's using one's intellect.
The world's a bit short on Talmudic scholars these days.
To say the least. Although I wouldn't mind having one on KPFA. I think it would be an interesting program every once in a while. I always come back to, my bottom line is, I want to find out what's going on that matters in the areas that are of concern to me. The areas of concern to me are, I think you're right, the same areas of concern to the founders of Pacifica. How do we have a more peaceful, healthful planet for all of us? That encompasses such a massive diversity of approaches that it could literally fill 24 hours a day on a radio station.
Well, what I'm discovering, I think I am discovering as I go along, but I'm trying to stay open-minded about it, is that there is a very real sense in which what has happened in KPFA from its foundation to the present can serve as a sort of a metaphor for what has happened in American society over that same period.
Don't push it.
Metaphors are useful insofar as they are defined and delineated and not, you know, stretched sideways too far. But I think it is true that many of the conflicts that have taken place within KPFA exemplify conflicts which have come to the fore in American society, particularly as related to the representation of the coming to terms with angry dissident minorities that increasingly those who came up and were educated in the 1960s and felt and were taught that you ought to listen to minorities and then find themselves in positions of authority where they're faced with the reality of what it means to listen to minorities and have terrible crises of conscience. And universities these days calling advisors saying, how do we deal with the incorporation into the curriculum of feminism, of gay rights, of Native Americans, all the rest of it. They're tearing themselves apart with trying to accommodate without letting them get too much in control.
Yeah, but if you read back into history, if you just want to take this country, you can take other countries. But you know, I all my life been a, I suppose, student of American history. Really, it's what I majored in college, and it's what I continue to try to bring things back to. If you go back to the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and the efforts of the dissidents of that time, the Emma Goldmans, the Sacco and Vanzettis. The we could name names, the anarchists, the Haymarket people, the IWW, the Wobblies, etc., and their efforts to make themselves heard in a pre-electronic media era through print and the suppression and the postal rate jigglings and the confiscation of newspapers and the absolute outright murders of people. Dissidents inside any culture who are taking on the establishment never have an easy time, because the more the establishment feels threatened, the more they're going to strike back violently against you. I think what we're seeing now is a really a relatively genteel struggle at this time. However, as President Kennedy once said, those who make nonviolent change impossible make violent revolution inevitable. And if we can't work out these relatively thorny matters of cultural diversity and representation and expression, we will be heading for another much more violent period in this country. As we sit here in October of 1994, we're about to face an election where some really unthinkable people may get elected to prominent positions in the United States, people of tremendous prejudice and ignorance and with very narrow agendas. That will not be accepted by a lot of people in this country, that will spark another dissident movement, I believe. Yeah. And, you know, something like Pacifica Radio is going to be more necessary than ever. Are we strong enough now? You know, it's one thing, it's a constant over the last 25 years that I can tell you, is that any time we seem to be moving into a period of crisis, and I believe we're moving into one now, we always seem to be too weak to be able to take on the responsibilities of that crisis, and yet somehow we always find the strength to do so.
Could you define in some way the nature of that crisis?
The one that's about to, the political crisis is about to come up?
I'm talking about Pacifica.
Our current situation, you mean, or the ongoing, the things that it has in common with previous periods of time?
No, our present situation.
Our present situation is that we have a financial crisis, which of course we always have. We even go into that. We have a crisis of transition of leadership. We have a constant challenging by the parts of the whole. People who believe that there really should be no Pacifica, there should only be my station, there really shouldn't be my station, there should only be my program, i.e. there should only be me. These have gone on since the beginning, too.
Both David Solnicker and Marcy Lockwood talked to me at some length in ways which did not conflict with each other about the struggle to expand network broadcasting in those areas in which network broadcasting is the only appropriate way, like not having five people call up Noam Chomsky when something happens.
And the reason we don't have that, of course, it would be ironic for David Solnicker to complain about this, is that he didn't do anything about it during his sense of his term as executive director. His idea of executive director was basically defusing crisis. My concept of leadership, as I attempted to practice it in my, and it's horrifying again for me to watch myself talk about that horrifying period of managing KPFA, was that not only did I try to keep the peace so that people wouldn't be at each other's throats, but I tried to show ways up and out of situations through inventive, creative solutions in programming and in structures so that we would get somewhere. We haven't had that in Pacifica for a long time. Mm-hmm. Our centralized structure, insofar as it exists, manages crisis and tries to defuse it and, if necessary, ignore it, hoping it'll go away. And I think we need a change in that area.
Yeah. Well, there's a certain kind of strength that is necessary in a situation like this, and I don't want to sound like I'm ass kissing to you for what a great man you are, but
I'll go ahead.
but
nobody else does.
But it is the case that at this moment, when there was nobody else to take it over, there wasn't a person of color there who had that breadth of vision.
There wasn't a person of anything.
There wasn't a woman there of you know, either sexual inclination who was there to take it. It happened to be you, and I would maintain that the reason that it was you is not because you were the uniquely talented Jesus Christ come down to earth, but because you were a person whose cultural frame of reference was sufficiently broad so that you could look at this great range of interests and say, that has an analogy at this point in history. We can learn from this point in history, and let's act accordingly.
Possibly. I mean, it certainly helped me to be who I was and doing what I did. But, you know, people get to be the right place at the right time. I mean, in a very different way, I was the right place at the right time during the Iran-Contra hearings, using a completely different, not completely different, but largely different set of skills. You know, that's what happens to you in life. It's been my experience being 57 years old. You find yourself in situations that you didn't create, and they tend to create you. That happened to me as manager of KPFA, and it's happened to me a few other times in life, inside and outside of Pacifica. But the fact that an institution does exist where you can have that happen to you and not have it based on material reward, for example, which is what 99% of the people in this country, consciously or unconsciously, are geared towards and programmed towards. Mm. Not have it based on any sense of fame. Not have it based on really any reward system whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Because the rewards of working for Pacifica are slim to non-existent. But if you are the type of person who can recognize, I was just talking to somebody the other day, a woman, you know, I speak to people at a lot of the Pacifica stations a lot of the time. They call me up. I speak to them about various things. This woman was hysterical. She was about to quit. She'd had a reverse in what she was trying to do at her station. She'd been to two psychologists in the past 3 weeks, and you know, nobody liked her. She came into work. She didn't want to come into work anymore and all this stuff. And I said to her, look, the rewards for what you do in this organization really have to be largely internal. You have to be able to go home and say, I did a really good program there. I did the best I could. I was able to, I was in that meeting and I was able to advance this cause a little bit further. I was able to suggest to somebody, I was able to teach somebody something, whatever you did that day that you felt good about. It's very rare that as you walk out of the station, there's going to be a line of people standing there applauding for you for having done it. Mm-hmm. You get most of your reinforcement in this organization for good work if you're on the air from the listeners. You get virtually none from the institution, and you get a lot of jealousy and backbiting inside the stations. It's not that you never get strokes. It's just that they're, you know, few and far between. And if you're not on the air person, it's even worse because people in the audience don't even know what you did, so they can't thank you for it and can't approach you. So you have to have a kind of a sense of self, really, that is resistant to not getting what we all want, which is, you know, honor, power, riches, and fame. That's Freud's words.
Yeah. Well, my favorite quote from myself in that that little monograph close to the end is that my conviction that the people at Pacifica were able to produce such amazing products, not because they were uniquely talented, but because they could afford the luxury of habitual integrity. And there are not many places where that is the case, where your only decision whenever you go on the air is say something is not, will it get me a job? But
will it stop me from being fired?
Am I saying something which, as far as I can tell, is true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the two things about reporting, I mean, that I teach, you know, like, there are really just two elements to reporting. One is go and find out, and the second is come back and tell the truth. And, you know, I try to boil things down to simple levels because I teach college level. And you can say that in six lectures or you can say it in two sentences. And I'm you know, trying to, as I get older, bring things down to maxims that people can easily understand and then talk about.
Yeah. I wonder, this doesn't relate to KPFA, but I'll ask you anyway. I imagine it must be terribly difficult to teach a subject like journalism and at a period in time when the control of the media is becoming more and more centralized, and more and more rigid.
That's the first thing you teach. Mm-hmm. You tell them, you deconstruct, as they now say.
Yeah.
We used to say analyze. Deconstruct. You analyze for people, you know, you make them see if they don't already know what's being presented to them and how. And there's really good texts that have been written about this. I mean, this is no secret. This isn't just you and me that just figured it out in this room. You know, I mean, you can go from Chomsky on up and down and present them with stuff that will let them understand Bagdikian and all these books about the centrality of control of the media and what it means to what we're being permitted to see. But, you know, it's really interesting. Pacifica, for the students that I teach in a working class school mostly. I teach a little at Stanford, but mostly I teach at Cal State Hayward, which is a state college. It's not at the state university system. It's a rung lower than that. It's a minority-majority school. Students are not
Ted
especially...
Ted Rozak was out there.
He still is. He's been there all these years. And I've been there for a little over... This is my third year there. And I've had over 200, maybe 250 students in all my classes so far. And of those 250 students, only one of them had even heard of KPFA before the class began. And it was because her father listened to it all the time. She didn't, but her dad wakes up and listens to it all the time. And when I get them to listen to it, when I assign it as part of their diversity of media experiences, very few of them stick with it afterward. Almost none, I would say, stick with it afterward. It's one of the, you know, I always say, and this is something I think you should pay attention to in your studies, that the most underrepresented minority in Pacifica programming, as far as target audience and workers at the stations, is not women, it's not gays, it's not African Americans, it's not Latinos, it's youth. We have a demographic that is very skewed towards older people, and in some cases really older people. Those older people who now say, oh, I can't listen to it anymore, or something like that, there's a lot of older people who do listen to it, who are 40 plus. And the way we present the programs and the way they don't change and the way we don't have young people on the air makes it extremely difficult for kids who are brought up today watching MTV and listening to the type of commercial radio stations that they do to make that transition to even testing Pacifica. Also given the fact that in their print media education, in the books that they read, they're no longer going to be in touch with the kind of text perhaps that was assumed for common culture by Lou Hill's generation. So this is something I'm constantly bringing up inside Pacifica. This is another one of my gadfly roles inside Pacifica, as I say. All right, African Americans, we need more African American women, we need more women, we need gays, all these minorities, yes, we're making great strides. We have no, look around you in this room and count the gray hairs, or people about to be. We're not paying attention to that. Now, that's a good way of assuring that in the future, you will have a much harder time even than you do in the present. Insofar as we have young people who listen to KPFA, in my experience, they are always the children of other KPFA listeners. And you will find people who now have three generations, four generations who've grown up, you know, listening to KPFA.
How would you respond to the suggestion that the education of youth today lies so strongly in the hands of dedicatedly commercial interests who are manufacturing and selling a particular kind of a youth culture that, over which youth have actually no more control than the purchasers of McDonald's hamburgers have over the content of the hamburgers that are supposedly reacting to popular demand.
How would I respond to that? I'd say let's do a program on it on KPFA and let's have youth in to talk about it. I don't want to see John Whiting and Larry Bensky talking about this on KPFA, lamenting the youth culture of today.
I was never suggesting it for a moment.
I mean, I would be, you know, interested, but certainly not indispensable in moderating such a discussion. I would like to see that there would be young people who would come in and be able to discuss this on their own. Now, we do have one project that is going on, Youth Radio, which occupies the storefront adjacent to KPFA. Symbolically enough, it's sort of ex-cathedra. It's outside the walls.
Indeed.
But it's right next door, and it's banging on the door waiting to come in.
That is not actually the meaning of ex-cathedra. It means
from inside it. Extramuros.
Extramuros, yes, right. Okay.
Extramuros.
We must be accurate about these things.
Thank you. It's early. Yeah. They're banging on those walls, and they want to come in. And if we know what's good for us, which often we don't, Pacifica, we'll let them in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, the questions that you asked before, who's going to talk? How's it going to be presented? Who's going to be, you know, doing blah, blah, blah? All of these are going to have to be resolved. But hell, you know, you write about it, you're a historian. We've been grappling with that question since day one in this organization. And I think it's a sign of health that we haven't found the solution yet.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, well, indeed, too many people have found solutions. It was something I had, and it went straight out of my head. In the words of Dr. Alzheimer.
No, I think we have a little ways for you to go there.
Yeah.
Still seem pretty sharp.
One thing that I think I have to face as a fact, and I remember what it was. I was going to quote what I consider to be a very useful soundbite from Marshall McLuhan.
Yes.
When he said that education should be a form of civil defense against media fallout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it's still now. But the thing that I think that I have to face is that I, as me, I'm going to be writing for elderly intellectuals of our...
No, not necessarily. No, I don't think you will be. I think you're going to be... I mean, this book will, you know, I believe, from what I've read of the first chapter or whatever part that becomes, I mean, it'll become the standard text on this organization, so it's going to be read by a lot of different people. I mean, I'm going to assign this to my next Stanford Broadcast Journalism class when I teach down there next as part of the history of radio. So, you know, you've already made an impact
far
beyond
that.
Now, don't assume who reads, and don't assume who listens to the radio either. It's, you know, reading is still free activity in this country, and so is radio. And you never know who's going to be tuning in out there. One of the frustrating things to me is we don't widen our audience, so we don't attempt to let people know what we're doing enough. We don't have a promotion component to our... One of the things I did when I was at KPFA is I understood immediately when we were in a crisis in that managerial thing that we had to get the word out and that it wasn't going to be done just by going on the air and saying, good evening, I'm the station manager and I'd like to tell you the following things. Only the people who listen are going to hear that. We had to go figure out how to get more people listening. And I went on a personal crusade to get articles written about the crisis. I know what they like to write about is personality, so I sold myself as a personality, which is not something I like to do very often.
Mm-hmm.
I got an article in the New York Times. I got an article in the San Francisco Chronicle. I got an article. I mean, I have a file of clippings somewhere, and I'm sure Vera Hopkins has them too, of all the personal publicity we did around the crisis, because I wanted people to know there was a crisis. And then they'll tune in and say, what the heck is this crisis about? And maybe they'll stick with us, and maybe they'll help us. I also instituted direct mail campaigns, which had never been done before. I made reference to this on the tape about the way we communicated with our listeners that had been old-fashioned. We did the first...
Millionaires were asked for $20.
Exactly. We did telemarketing. I had a group of people in there every night who were dialing out to every phone number we could find of old subscribers for the first time in KPFA. We made a lot of our money back that way. We did everything that I thought was modern that could be adopted. I am not a Luddite. We had a subscriptions department, for example, where people did not want to use credit cards. They would not You know, it's too much trouble to process these. I say, well, this is the type of money that people are now using, you see. If you wanted people to come in here with silver dollars, bite them and throw them on the table because that's the old form of money, you're telling me that that's the way you want to do business. Mm-hmm. People don't do business that way anymore. They charge it on credit cards.
I have this vision of a sort of an old, aged KPFA hippie sitting out on the pavement in front with a cop and a sign saying, "We'll talk for food."
There you go. We had, speaking of food, I mean, we were literally so broke that many of us collectively lived together. And every day for over a year when we went back after the strike, we had a catered lunch catered by, well, you know, not a caterer, but we had a person who prepared lunch who brought it in and served it to everyone at the station so we would have at least one meal a day that we knew we could count on free.
School meals.
Exactly. I mean, we had to do all kinds of extraordinary things then to survive. It was really survival time. And, you know, I am, as I think about it, as I watch that tape, extremely proud of what we did in those years and of my role in it. But that was then and this is now. And we've got an immense, you know, challenge ahead of us now. We have become, what is it, $7 million a year, the annual budget of Pacifica now, something like that, and all the stations, all the components.
I think David said closer to eight.
It's always going up. I don't read the figures constantly. Well, this money has to come from somewhere. The most solid, reliable, responsible, dignified, traditional base is listener support. I still believe in that. I don't want to go to corporations for money or large foundations.
That means but Dave Bunce said that at the moment, the support for KPFA comes more from grants of various sorts than it does from subscription.
I don't think that's true. I think you need to take a look at that. I think it's still up around 70% from subscriptions. I think you may have misunderstood that. Take a look at the annual report that just came out. I'm sure you have.
Well,
they just finished a marathon. They made almost $300,000. They do that four times a year, so that's about $1.2 million, $1.1 million, something like that. I mean, you can compare it, but I don't think it's at the point yet. There is more. I mean, you wouldn't be in that. We wouldn't be in that building today if they hadn't gone out and found people that shake the money tree.
Dave again said 55 people were the core of what made that possible.
Right, and these are all lefties. You know, people in many cases went back to the founding years of the station, or in some cases, new young people who younger people who had gotten onto the message, but. The truth of the matter is that the last great period of collective social ferment in this country ended in 1975, approximately, with the end of the Vietnam War. And we are now talking about a generation of people, almost 20 years of whom have grown up without knowing what it is to do collective political activity. To them, political activity means what happens around election time. And that's not what political activity should be limited to. Therefore, even people who are in their, let's say, early 20s then or in their early 40s now, as of necessity they are, is the way the culture goes, they have a little more money than they did then, in some cases a lot more money. Some of that they will give to Pacifica and are giving to Pacifica. What we have to worry about is what happens when this generation that's now between 20 and 40 starts to get older. Which of them are going to continue to support us? And how are we going to get the ones who are now in their 20s? The organization has learned under Solnicker and Bunce and Greg Lassonde and Pat Scott and people like that how to milk better the older listeners and traditional people that we've attracted over the years.
Dick said they all went to fundraising school at one point.
Yeah, and I'm not against that. I'm not saying, you know, I'm against that at all. That's important. And diversifying your sources of income. I don't think we should discriminate against somebody who wants to write us a $20,000 check. You know, I'm not saying that. But we also have to understand that the basic principles under which, and by the way, the one mistake I found in your book, in your monograph, was when you said that KPFA has never reached the 2% of the listener threshold. They actually now are closer to 15%. There are something like 130,000 regular listeners managed by Arbitron, of whom 20,000 are subscribers.
But that was not 2% of the listeners. It was 2% of the potential listeners in the whole community.
2% of the potential who would then support the station?
2% of those with FM sets.
I see. Oh, no, we're nowhere near that. I mean, that's...
That was what Lou Hill was talking about.
We got over 2% who would send money. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When we did Iran-Contra, our Arbitron numbers went up to the highest that they've ever been in many markets, and we were up above 2 in this market and in L.A. and a few other places. We're usually down in the low 1s, which would be would kill a commercial station. We can stay alive because we're not commercial. But the Iran-Contra hearings, as they built us huge audiences mm-hmm. in various places. And that's a freakish mm-hmm. occurrence. Look, this is never going to be... by its nature, a mass audience. It takes too many chances. It has too many missions. It's too amateurish. It's, you know, a lot of things. It's never going to attract enormous numbers. But if you see right now the way the listenership of the stations is stagnant and even declining, we have now...
Dick talked about that yesterday.
We have 130,000 QM or something like that for KPFA, 160, 170 in L.A. and New York. To my way of thinking, as somebody who's been in commercial broadcasting and who teaches broadcasting in addition to my Pacifica work, it's almost impossible technically to turn a transmitter on the top of the Empire State Building with the power of WBAI or on top of Mount Wilson with the power of KPFK Los Angeles and have fewer listeners than we now do. It's almost technically impossible. I don't care what you put on there. Cats howling, whales farting. You would get as many listeners as we now do. I mean, we are doing something seriously, radically wrong in those markets, and not so much better in Berkeley either, if we can't have better audience outreach. Now, part of that is the programming, a big part. But part of it is also the promotion. We do not promote. We have no mentality, no budget for taking out ads, getting billboards. We do send out bumper stickers. They grind out a press release and, you know, who knows where it falls. We don't cultivate mentions. We don't get newspaper stories written about the good things that we do. We don't get our programs promoted in advance anywhere. I'm about to go back to Washington and do election night broadcasting for the whole network. I dare say it won't appear in any newspaper that's going to be on. I mean, we service our constituency alone without seeking to expand it, and that's very dangerous and short-sighted. And it's partially because the leadership that we've had does not come out of broadcasting and the broadcasting end of the spectrum. None of our executive directors that Pacifica's had, since we had the first one, Joel Kugelmas, had any broadcasting background. Kugelmas, Sharon Maida, David Solnick, or Pat Scott, who's now acting executive director, maybe executive director, all have come out of other areas. They never... You know, like they say in business, they never met a payroll. You know, they're trying mm-hmm, to put somebody mm-hmm. down.
Yeah.
Never met a payroll. These people never met a microphone before mm-hmm. they came into Pacifica. They have other skills and other talents. They never promoted anything. They never, you know, did outreach to get mentioned. They had, mm-hmm. they're there for other reasons. And we do not behave, Pacifica Radio does not behave like a mass media institution needs to behave. This is not Lou Hill time anymore. We do not have the only FM station on the radio. Mm-hmm. We are one of 50 or 60 in various, mm-hmm. well, 30 yeah. or 40.
But I think it relates to the fact that people don't use radio for the same thing that they used to use radio for.
Well, then let's go to them and figure out what they're using it for and help them use it. I mean, we cannot turn back the clock and say, you must be what we want you to be. We have to reach mm-hmm. them where they
yeah.
are.
Well, a principal thing that they're using it for is to keep themselves from going crazy in traffic jams. But that is a particular kind of a middle-class employed person who gets caught in traffic jams.
Well, but we also have, you know, in Los Angeles, that's an extremely important market.
There's a brand new thesis that has just arrived from University of Oregon, I think.
I read him. I spoke to him, too.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Naturally, they all, I mean, mm-hmm. eventually
yeah.
get to me. I mean,
uh-huh. yeah. Well, that just arrived.
I haven't seen
it. It arrived like yesterday. Dick passed it to me, and during my lunch break, I went out to Copy Mat and got it. So I've got a copy of that, hot off the press.
He seemed quite a knowledgeable person, a serious person to me, the one at
Yeah.
Oregon.
Yeah. A thing that has put me off, I've just started a bit of it. I'm put off when I find both typographical and grammatical errors with some frequency in a PhD dissertation.
Shouldn't be there. I'm
Yeah, that bothers me.
sure. So what else can I tell you this morning?
Yeah. Well, God.
By the way, when you get down to writing this eventually, if you want, I'd be happy to read, whatever
Well,
section this is.
thank you very much. Well, I can. I'll tell you that one thing that I have. I've set about this in the usual KPFA Pacifica fashion. That is to say, as a result of turning this out, people that I interviewed and sent copies of it to afterwards. And let me say, first of all, the thing which pleased me more than anything else was that people who had been at each other's throats at the time wrote back to me or even phoned me up and said that I had presented them fairly and that they had no corrections to make and no faults to find. So that I found encouraging. The other thing that happened was that they started climbing all over my back saying, "You've got to bring this up to date, expand it, fill it out, make a book out of it."
And
And
of course, the 50th anniversary is coming up. I mean, that's the ideal time that this must come out by then.
Yeah. Well,
It'll be the
again, in the Pacifica
deadline.
fashion, I have no publisher. I have no backing at this point. But I've learned long ago in the things that I spend the rest of my life doing that if you have a good idea and you say, "Oh boy, let's get some money for it," and you sit around waiting for the money, you're sitting around for the rest of your life. If, on the other hand, you say, "Well, let's start doing it," and you go out and you start doing it and you're talking to people, and somewhere along the line somebody says, "Oh, you're doing that. I always thought somebody should do that. Here's some money." So
Let's hope that that's true.
I am the I'm the I'm the you know, perennial phenomenon of the writer in search of the publisher.
I have an agent in New York. If you like, I'll give you her address and phone number. She deals with major publishers. The commercial possibilities of this are not limitless, but they do have a, I mean, there is a potential tie-in here in that KPFA and Pacifica are now so premium-driven in their fundraising, and this is something I don't like, and this is something that, are you recording that?
Yes. Let me say, by the way, that anything that you precede with the words "off the record"
But I haven't
is
used
off the
those words
record.
yet.
Okay. But if you do,
No, I'm too much of a journalist to go off the record with somebody who's writing a book, with a microphone on my chest. No retrospective off the records here. I was going to say that in the course of desperately trying to raise money when I was manager, we were doing marathons on the air, of course, as KPFA has done. And it would be interesting to find out when the first one was, because I believe Elsa invented them, but I've never been able to really pin down when that was. And it's really, I think, important from your point of view to try to figure that out. Have you talked to Denny Smithson, by the way?
No.
Denny was one of Elsa's boys and was a key figure in the public affairs department under Elsa, and was a transitional figure in that he was still there when the new gang came in. He still does a weekly program about books on KPFA, and he's a longtime employee of Cody's Books up on Telegraph Avenue, where you can find him. But I was thinking today, well, I know some of the people you've probably spoken to. Who would it be good for you to speak to? And it occurred to me that Denny is somebody who is probably important for you to, possibly important for you to talk to. I don't know.
Yeah, I have to say my primary emphasis on this, and don't duck when I say this. You don't fall into this category, but I really particularly wanted to get onto those people who might very well not be around the next time.
Thank you.
That I came over.
But the next time you come, it may be.
But that,
so you
that,
talked to Trevor Thomas.
Well, I talked to him over the phone before I did this, and I don't think I've got an awful lot more to get there than I did.
I'll give you my tapes of that whole episode on the air. I think that was a pretty full debrief.
Oh boy, anything of this sort would be extremely, extremely useful. But I got into Gert Kyoreto, obviously, when she was still alive. And oh boy, thank heavens I did.
Very important.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I went up to Point Arena day before two days ago.
Dick Moore?
Tuesday, to talk to Dick Moore.
Good, that's very important.
And I had sent him a copy of this in advance. I arrived at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we talked continuously until 10:30, without a break, through dinner, through everything. Not all of this recorded,
mind you. Is his health
good? Oh, well, at the moment, he is sort of taking firsts in marathon running in his age category.
How old is he, 75 or something?
He's up there into his 70s,
yeah.
So sort of early 70s. And then we got up at 7:30 the next morning, and we talked straight through until 2 in the afternoon.
Boy, have you got transcription work to do.
Well, of this, in fact, I only got between 3 and 4 hours that I actually took down, because a lot of the time we weren't talking about KPFA, we were talking about the history of poetry in the Bay Area.
Let me get your coffee, that's why the microphone's
on. All that stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what else can I tell you today? Without keeping you here till 10:30 at night. Or me here, too, because I've got things I'm going to do.
Yeah, actually, I've got I'm meeting Pat Scott at 12 at the station.
Give her my best.
Tell her
you just spent the morning with me and I
told
the truth.
Yeah, I said I've just talked to Larry Bensky, and what have you got to say for yourself? Well, there's nothing else that's sort of tearing at my brain that I've got to ask. I'm assuming that if this goes ahead, this is not likely to be the last conversation that we have.
Hopefully not.
So there's plenty to.